FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Today's show is brought to you by Blue Sky Uranium Corporation. Blue Sky has first mover advantage in Argentina in the world's newest uranium and vanadium district. With an existing near surface deposit that's open for expansion, Blue Sky also controls a massive district scale land package with mineralization along a 145 kilometer long trend. Blue Sky possesses tremendous exploration upside and is an excellent leverage play on rising uranium and vanadium prices. The company is run by a best-in-class management and technical team with proven exploration and development success in Argentina. Blue Sky Uranium trades under the ticker symbol BSK on the Toronto Venture Exchange and as BKUCF on the OTC. For more information and to stay on top of the latest news, go to blueskyuranium.com. That's blueskyuranium.com.
The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Carrie Lutz. It's 3/11/19. Wow, this month is marching quickly by. Well, it hasn't been a great month for metals. Not a great month so far for the stock market. Pretty good month for the dollar. Will all of that continue, or is the trend going to be reversed? Well, we see some quantitative easing on the horizon. Perhaps it will be here before you even know it. Central banks are beginning to loosen up. And hey, as always, be a part of the show and email us at kl@carrielutz.com. We answer all. I'm a few, 50, 60 emails behind. I was in PDAC in Toronto for most of last week, and it was so cold there I could barely touch my keyboard. Forget it. I don't know how you Canadians live in the Arctic North. I don't know if I could take it at this point, but we're back and it's 83 degrees and I am happy to have John Rubino on again. Make sure you check out his site, dollarcollapse.com. And John, happy Monday. So we're looking at central banks reversing course. Well, certainly they're reversing what they said they were going to do. Are they reversing action wise?
Hey, Gary. Yeah, you know, that's a very big story right now that hasn't gotten a lot of play, but everybody knows the Fed tightened a little bit in the last year. Not a lot, but a little bit. And they, they raised interest rates a bit. They let some of their balance sheet run off. And then when the stock market flaked out at the end of the year, they were forced to backtrack and are now on hold, at least with possible easing coming in the year ahead. But even more interesting is what happened with the other big central banks. For instance, the European Central Bank was extremely easy for the last few years. You know, negative interest rates for a lot of the big European borrowers, huge increases in the ECB's balance sheet, which is to say huge increases in the European money supply. And they started talking about tightening last year, but never even got a chance to do it because with the turmoil that is happening in the Eurozone right now, France's yellow vest protests that is forcing the French government to increase spending dramatically, and the Italian government's turmoil and insistence on running bigger deficits, and along with the near death of the Italian banking system, has forced the European Central Bank to backtrack even before it got started. And they just came out with a big course reversal where now they're giving big loans to the European banks and talking about increasing quantitative easing and pushing interest rates back down. So they never even got the chance to tighten. All they did was talk about it a little bit, and they're back to easing again. Same thing with the Japanese central bank. There was some talk last year that they were going to start tightening at some point in the not too distant future. And then the head of the Bank of Japan came out and said, no, we need to keep 2% inflation in mind, which we haven't achieved yet. So we're going to continue to increase the money supply, keep interest rates at extremely low levels for basically as far as the eye can see. Now, what this means is that the central banks had their chance to tighten at the end of this cycle, which is what almost always happens in the business cycle. Central banks will tighten towards the end when inflationary pressures start to pick up, and then dramatically cut interest rates when the economy finally turns down. Well, we're 10 years into an expansion. Inflation is starting to pick up, at least in terms of wages. You know, we're seeing wage inflation start to rise a bit in the U.S. And we're seeing asset prices at extremely high levels. In other words, all the precursors to a recession, all the things that normally slow an economy down and send it into a couple of years of contraction are here, which means at some point in the not too distant future, the economy turns down. You know, it's the longest ever expansion already. So we should assume that it's pretty soon. But the central banks have no ammunition with which to fight the next turndown, because already interest rates are zero to negative in Europe and Japan. And in the U.S., we raise short-term rates a little bit, but normally the Fed cuts rates by about 5 percentage points to combat a recession. And we're only up to about 2.5% on the Fed funds rate. So that means the Fed, if it's going to lower interest rates by the normal amount in the next recession, would have to go to 2.5% negative. So this is totally uncharted territory. We've never seen central banks have so little ammo heading into a downturn, which means that either they won't be able to counter it when the time comes, which is new. You know, we've never seen central banks not be able to lean against a contraction in economic activity, or they have to do some really extreme stuff, some things that have never been seen before, like extremely negative interest rates or just huge increases in asset purchases. And in a lot of these places, there aren't that many bonds left to buy. So they're going to have to move on to other asset classes, which means it could be equities next time, where they just step in and start buying up the stock market or whatever. So what has happened lately with the central banks not being able to tighten at all and having to reverse course without ever having tightened is a very big deal, because it means we're in uncharted territory. Stuff is going to happen going forward that has never happened before. So we can't know how it turns out. But, you know, financial history says that a lot of this stuff, in the aggregate, when it's done together, is pretty dangerous. It means currency values fall and inflation spikes. And we'll see if it happens this time. But it's the kind of thing that, economic textbooks, if they matter anymore, used to say would probably happen. So we will see.
Yeah. Do they matter anymore? That's really the question. That's what I want to know. And my opinion, obviously, is probably similar to yours. And the answer is yes. But when is the question? When are they going to matter? When is it going to make a difference? And I wish I had an answer for you out there, but I don't, other than to say it's probably getting closer. All right.
Yeah. I mean, there's a number out there that we'll look back on with 2020 hindsight and say, okay, that was the end of the debt binge. Maybe it's the U.S. national debt. Maybe it's total debt in the U.S. Maybe it's total global debt. But, you know, someday there will be a number that we look back on and say, okay, that ended the process. The debt orgy ended when we hit this level. And obviously, since debt is soaring right now, we're heading towards that number, whatever it is. We're already at completely unprecedented levels of debt globally, and we're increasing that debt at an accelerating rate. That's what's so scary about this now is normally at the end of a cycle, debt growth, at least at governmental levels, starts to flatten out and sometimes even contracts, because everybody's at work. They're all paying taxes. Corporations' shares are really high. That means lots of capital gains for the people who sell those shares, and lots of new IPOs, which is huge infusions of capital gains for the owners of those companies. That kind of stuff usually pumps up government tax revenues and leads governments to to borrow less or to actually pay off a little bit of debt, like in the 1990s. But it's not happening this time. Everybody's increasing their deficit spending. At the same time, private sector debt is soaring. So, you know, assuming there's a wall out there that the global financial system can't go beyond in terms of leverage, we're heading for it at an accelerating rate. So again, you know, as you said, we can't know the timing, but we know we're headed that way. So at some point, we're going to hit it, and then everything's going to change.
Yeah, it's going to change. Things never remain the same. We'd like them to, we think. But how do you grow if you're just doing the same thing every day with no variation on the theme, right? I mean, you need change. It's vital to humans. It's vital to you as an individual. It's vital to societies. It's vital to economic systems, John.
Well, all of those things. Yeah. And you know, in life, when you're doing something that's dangerous and leads to bad outcomes, you can't do it forever, but you can get away with doing it for quite a while. You know, we've all experienced mm-hmm. that in life where we went down a path that, that was probably the wrong path to go down, but we got away with it for quite a while and maybe even convinced ourselves we could do it forever because we'd gotten away with it at first. And that's what the global financial system is doing right now. It's on a path. It's clearly mathematically unsustainable. It's been able to get away with it for a really, really long time. And that's convinced a lot of people, including a lot of economists who ought to know better, that maybe we can just keep on doing this forever because maybe we figured out the secret to borrowing greater amounts of money year after year after year forever and keeping it together. And that's spawning some new economic theories. One of which is modern monetary theory, which is dressed up debt monetization, but it's a rationalization for us wanting to keep the current system of extremely high government spending and governments that encourage the private sector to take on more and more leverage year after year. It's a rationalization for that process that says that governments don't even have to borrow. And they don't have to tax. They can just print as much new money as they want to and fund themselves that way. You know, very smooth, very clean, very simple system. But of course, you know, the next level of self-destruction, when you just look at the math, if the amount of currency in the system is going to increase at an accelerating rate going forward, then you get one of those, you know, parasite devouring the hosts kind of situations where eventually the value of the currency plunges because everybody sees that it's in oversupply, you know, and that's the thing that's never addressed by these rationalizations for bad behavior. And that's because the rationalizations aren't really about rational thought. You know, they're just about keeping the deal flow going for a little while longer. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that in previous bubbles where in the 1990s, earnings started to look crazy in terms of stock valuations. So people started saying, well, earnings are optional and eyeballs are what matters for tech stocks. And then in the housing bubble, home prices always go up. Therefore, it doesn't matter how much you borrow against your house because the price will always go up, you know, and that... Right. That was just as crazy as eyeballs from a historical standpoint. You know, with retrospect, with 2020 hindsight, we see that was a terrible idea. Yeah. And now we're into the next version of that. And that will also blow up, but we don't know when.
Yeah, well, the political system sure looks like it's blowing up here. Socialism, we spent trillions of dollars getting people to understand and fighting the rise of socialism in Asia, in Europe, all over the world, in Latin America. And now we've got the Bernie contingent that embraces socialism and believes that it is the bomb for all that ails humanity. And this is kind of madness here, isn't it?
Well, socialism is kind of the Donald Trump of the left. Basically, you know, Trump was a result of people seeing that the system didn't work anymore for them. And therefore, they became willing to vote for an outsider who is willing to, you know, tear the old system out by the roots and start over. So that's how we got Donald Trump. For the left, socialism is a much more attractive thing to move on to after center-left neoliberalism is seen to not work anymore. So with the same kind of attitude, you know, Bernie Sanders says, we're going to give you free this and free this and free this, and we'll pay for it in part by taxing the rich, and don't worry about how else we'll get the money. We'll get it. Don't worry about it. You know, we're just going to help people right now in the moment. And I get that impulse. You know, if you see people suffering, you want to help them. And there are a lot of people who are suffering in various ways out there now because the current system doesn't work. So it's an impulse that's very understandable. Also because it hasn't really been an issue for a long time and people have short memories. You know, a lot of people really don't know that socialism has been tried and failed on an epic scale over and over again in the previous century because they didn't live through any of that. And for a lot of us, our memories only extend to what we've lived through. So it could well be that we do a socialist experiment in the U.S. again, because the next election is very possibly going to be between Donald Trump, who's wounded by all these investigations, and the fact that the economy isn't as strong in 2020 as it seems to be right now, versus maybe a Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren ticket. That's completely possible right now.
What a frightening prospect.
And the other thing to remember is that it's also possible that the Democrats nominate Joe Biden or somebody like that, somebody from the Clinton wing of the party, which would start a civil war in the Democrat Party. Because let's say 47% of the Democrat base now identifies as socialist. You know, they're buying into the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, AOC kind of point of view right now, that let's stop with the incrementalism and let's just go for it. Let's just implement the world as the world should be and not worry about the niceties of how we pay for it and everything. So it's not clear that those guys would support somebody from the Clinton wing of the party again, because that's perceived as a huge failure last time around. I mean, Hillary couldn't even beat Donald Trump. So how is Biden going to do it? You know, what's he got that she didn't have? It's not clear that the Democrats are going to be a unified force going into the next election. But it's also possible that they will be, and they'll have coalesced around somebody that used to be considered way out in the, you know, left field politically, but that now is completely mainstream for where the Democratic Party is. So that, you know, really interesting times. I would say that whoever ends up in charge next time around is going to borrow a ton of money at the government level and encourage the private sector to borrow a lot of money, which is to say business as usual, you know? So this is more entertainment than it is substantive policy issue right now. You know, it's we're going to get a government that spends a ton of money and borrows a ton of money regardless. And if we go to modern monetary theory, then we'll get a government that just spends a ton of money and prints a lot of money. You know, it's
either way,
it's not
going to
be that
money.
Different. Yeah.
Right. Either way. So let's look at precious metals. They took a hit, bounced back a little bit on Friday. As we speak now, it's right around 1230. Gold is down $5 the ounce to right around 1292. Silver is down around a nickel to 1525. CO2 report is showing some interesting things, isn't it?
Well, this has been a very interesting stretch for the Commitment of Traders report, because so much of the data was delayed by the government shutdown towards the end of last year. And so they basically just, they calculated the data, but they held on to it. They didn't release it. And then they started releasing it twice a week instead of once a week. And what it showed when it finally started coming out was that the speculators went wildly bullish, and the commercials went wildly bearish in December. So in other words, the Commitment of Traders report got very negative for gold and silver back when we weren't paying attention to it because the numbers weren't coming out. And so gold and silver went up a little bit, and then that imbalance in the futures market started to bite, and precious metals went back down a bit. So we've got a little correction from what was a pretty decent run in late December and January and February. But at the same time, the speculators are starting to swing aggressively back to being negative. In other words, this spooked them, so they're going negative again. And because the speculators are usually wrong at extremes, you know, when they develop a very clear idea of what they think is going to happen and place their bets, the opposite usually happens. So another couple of weeks, like the last couple of weeks, and the structure of the futures market will be positive again for gold and silver. So this might continue. In other words, the kind of grinding decline in precious metals prices that we're seeing right now might continue for a little while longer, but not much longer, if the the futures market is what is going to determine the price going forward. So, you know, we're moving out of the favorable seasonal period. So we don't have Indian and Chinese buying as big a help as it was over the last couple of months. But we could see the futures market turn positive pretty soon, and that might support prices for a while. And again, you know, the underlying fundamentals for gold and silver are insanely bullish. All the stuff we just talked about with central banks, for instance, and with politics, are great for precious metals, because if you've got central banks aggressively easing, at the same time we're electing people who are untested and who have some ideas that involve massive increases in spending and borrowing, that's pretty close to paradise for gold bugs. Not for anybody else, but for gold bugs, it's a great time to be investing in precious metals, because everything is lined up to push them higher. And again, it's a timing issue. We don't know how the elections are going to go. We don't know when the Japanese and European central banks are going to start aggressively easing the way they've announced they're going to. We don't know when the U.S. central bank is going to start cutting interest rates, rather than just sitting around and being data dependent and seeing what happens. But we know all that stuff is probably going to happen. And once it happens in a coordinated way, in other words, once the central banks are all doing pretty much the same thing, which is aggressively easing, a lot of money is going to be flowing into the financial system. And it could go into equities again, but equities are already at record levels. It could go into bonds again, which it probably will, but bonds are already not far from record levels. So the only thing that's cheap right now is precious metals. So I think the odds favor a really good market for them with all this other stuff that's happening now.
Yeah, I am inclined to agree with you, and I'm seeing optimism become prevalent in the mining sector, guarded optimism, not like before, where it could never go down and it was going to infinity, kind of like what you saw in Bitcoin. So when you take all these things into consideration, this could easily be the time, right?
Well, there's another interesting thing in the mining sector, which is that the big miners can't find enough gold and silver to replace what they're taking out of the ground, which Correct. Makes sense. I mean, we've been looking for gold and silver for 4,000 years. So obviously, we've found all the easy deposits, and most of what's left is hard to get to and therefore very expensive to mine and not all that rich. You know, the grades that Right. these guys are discovering in their newest exploration projects are not as high as what they used to discover. And that is bad for the big guys, which is why we're seeing all this consolidation. You know, you saw Right. Barrick and Newmont making some big acquisitions lately, and now Barrick wants to buy Newmont, you know? So these guys are trying to find efficiencies wherever they can. And the next place they're going to find them is by buying out the highest quality junior miners. And there are some small miners who have found what look like some big, rich deposits that could actually move the needle for somebody like Barrick or Newmont. And those guys are now acquisition candidates, presumably at nice multiples to today's prices. So that will be one of the defining stories of the mining industry in the next couple of years, is the big guys buying out the little guys, which in a way is kind of a shame because, yeah, you know, say you own Novo Resources or Great Bear Resources or somebody like that that's getting some attention right now, and they get bought out for twice today's price. Well, you doubled your money, so you feel reasonably smart because it's always good to double your money. But you miss out on the run that would have happened if they'd stayed independent and just grown and become a producer that's making lots of money. You know, you're looking at a 10-bagger in some of these scenarios. And so if you get bought out for twice that, you know, twice today's price, you missed that huge run that would have happened. So I know that's a problem that a lot of people would like to have, only doubling their money, but it still is kind of frustrating for people who have been in these junior miners for this grinding 4 or 5 years of mostly down markets for them and are just starting to see the juniors start to come back up.
Yeah. Well,
you know, you want a run that is equal to the decline that you had to live through to get to that run.
Yes, that's for sure. And I've talked to a lot of mining company execs. They said they wouldn't even consider selling their companies for twice the market price that they're going for now. How that will really turn out in the real world is another thing, but it's nice to hear them say it anyways. And hey, that is it for today. So make sure you take a look at John's site, dollarcollapse.com, our site, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Sign up for a free newsletter. Got one coming out shortly concerning the death of manners and common courtesies in America. I think you'll definitely want to read it. The email address again for questions, comments, kl@carrielutz.com, Twitter feed @CarrieLutz, and the Facebook page, Financial Survival Network. John, we will catch up with you next week.
Thanks, Carrie. See ya.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.